The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Try to figure out how to get it done, because Lord knows there's a lot of work to do, and that's what we talk about here on the Green Front, talking about the many ecological challenges we face as a country, as a planet, as a species. And we have some good news this week. Lord knows there's been enough bad news on the climate front with the Senate passing the buck, or just completely out to lunch on the urgently needed climate bill, and also with the fires raging, floods flowing in Pakistan, in Russia, with record heat waves all across the east coast of this country and in other parts of the globe. It is, kind of a difficult time to think about what we're facing, but when we do have good news to report, we'd like to get it on. I'm talking about news last week that the Environmental Protection Agency is finally clamping down on cement plant pollution. That is after some dozen years and about four lawsuits, and we're going to talk to one of the key proponents of that clampdown. Jim Pugh is joining us momentarily from Earth Justice, one of my favorite green organizations. In our second half, I'll be chatting with a friend of mine, Diane McKecker, and if you don't know about her great work and book, it's called The Big Green Purse, and she promotes women taking action as consumers to demand greener products and programs and choices. And her latest idea was to go to supermarkets to get moms who are concerned about the lack of green products, and only 3.5% of all produce in America's grocery stores is organic, to go to the storekeepers themselves, the managers, and demand, or request nicely, but if they need to, get a little bit more pushy about wanting to have more earth-friendly products to purchase for their families. And we'll tell you how that's going with Diane. We'll be speaking to her at the bottom of the hour. It's now my pleasure to welcome to the Green Front Jim Pugh. Thanks for joining us on pretty short notice today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
And I wanted to celebrate the fact that there's finally some good news. It's a long time coming, a lot of hard work. Tell us a little bit about the background to get this first ever cap on mercury and some other toxins established.
Oh, well, I guess first let me tell you about this category of polluters, the cement kilns. I mean, these have long been among the worst polluters in California and across the country. We have about 100 cement plants in the country. Many of them, and there are quite a few of them in California. I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's around 10. There are a group that sort of ring Los Angeles, and there are another few in Northern California, including a very big emitter in Cupertino.
Oh, my goodness, that's right next door to where I grew up in Saratoga. That was before it was known as Silicon Valley down there. That's right. I know right where you're talking about, too. Thanks for reminding me.
Is that
the Kaiser plant?
Well, it's owned by Lehigh now, but a lot of the plant's ownership changes, over and over again.
So when I was growing up, so that was about 30 years ago, actually. But I do remember that now that you mention it.
And it's one of the worst mercury emitters of any kind in the country. And to sort of underline what good news this is, EPA is going to get cuts in mercury emissions from cement kilns of over 90%. So, that is a problem that's plagued that area for decades, and it's finally going to be brought under control.
Has anyone tied health concerns, like have there been any outbreaks of cancer, or, any cluster outbreaks around these cement plants?
Well, they haven't done a good job at all of calculating the health effects of the pollution from cement plants. And that's not because the health problems don't exist. It's just that there hasn't been, the funding and the other resources that should have been put into looking at the health problems deployed. And you can get a lot of anecdotal evidence from people who live around these kilns that, in fact, there are a lot of bad health effects, but it just hasn't been quantified.
And we hear a lot about, and I talk a lot about the mercury emissions that come from coal-fired power plants, which I guess account for about half of the mercury emissions in this country, according to this article I have in front of me in the USA Today. Maybe you can clarify that. But why have we not heard as much about the problems from cement plants?
I don't know. I mean, that's one that has had me scratching my head for a long time.
Not as sexy plants, an emission source or what?
I don't know. You know, cement plants as a group are not as bad as power plants. They, power plants, you know, emit about 45 tons or 48 tons, and cement plants were closer to 11 or 12 tons. But there are 600 plants, power plants, and only 100 cement plants. So on a individual basis, they can be even worse. In fact, some of the worst mercury emitters of any kind in the whole country are cement plants.
Now, tell us the process of making cement that causes these toxins to be released in the form of mercury.
That's a really good question to ask, because it's almost hard to visualize what is going on at these plants. These are enormous plants, and the operative unit is the kiln, which is a big tube that can be the length of a football field. And in that tube, they cook rock at thousands of degrees Fahrenheit. So they're using an incredible amount of fuel, often a dirty fuel like coal, sometimes even trash, and that generates lots of pollution. Of course, burning coal, you know, in a cement kiln is no different than burning coal in a power plant. It generates lots of pollution all by itself. But to make matters even worse, they're using it to cook rock, which also has lots of impurities in it. And, you know, the things like the mercury and the lead and the arsenic and the chromium that are in that rock that's being cooked also get vaporized, and it all comes out the smokestack.
Wow, I understand there's one of these big cement plants in Texas as well.
There are a number of these big plants in Texas. In fact, there's one town in Texas called Midlothian, which has the distinction, which some of the residents are not too pleased about being called the cement capital of America, because it has four plants grouped right around one fairly small town, including a plant that is literally next door to the local school.
Wow, and there's a picture of that Midlothian plant in the USA Today. That's why I asked about it. It looks pretty scary looking, actually. I mean, industrial, but now that we know what, you know, comes out of them, which you can't see, right? That's why we didn't know until recently the health impacts. I literally grew up next door to it not knowing.
That's right. You can't see a lot of the worst pollution. A number of residents near plants say that they often find dust in their yards and on their cars and on their houses. But what you don't see is the mercury coming out, or the organic pollution like benzene, which is carcinogenic, coming out. What we do see is the tip of the iceberg.
Now, this has been going on for about a dozen years and several lawsuits later. Why did it take this long? Does it have something to do with the administration in power in Washington, D.C. now and what we've had prior? Or how much of this was political? It seems like so much of our environmental legislation, unfortunately, is.
Well, it's true. A lot of it's political. But, I mean, you're right. At the start of the story, you said this is a good news story. And the good news is once in a while, the government gets something right. And, you know, we now have an administration that cares about communities, and a new EPA administrator, Lisa Jackson, who really cares about communities. And having them come in, actually wanting to get a grip on this problem made a huge difference. And so, you know, instead of having to, drag EPA kicking and screaming towards these regulations, we were actually able to work with the agency and get very good, very protective regulations out in fairly short order once the new administration came in.
I understand you were the one who actually filed all four of these suits, but they were on behalf of a number of environmental and public health groups.
Yes, that's right. We started working on this issue in the 1990s, and have represented a number of groups, including large national groups like Sierra Club, and also smaller groups like the group that's working in Midlothian, Texas, Downwinders at Risk, on this issue.
And how much less emissions will be spewed because of this?
That's one of the really impressive things about this rule. So the mercury is going to be cut by over 90%. The particulate matter, which is one of the worst types of pollution that's coming out of these kilns, both because particulate matter is so bad for people. It can get deep into their lungs and do damage, but also because it happens to contain a lot of the metals that come out of cement kilns, that's going to be cut by over 90%. Acid gases like hydrogen chloride, over 90%. And the organic pollution like benzene and other sort of toxic hydrocarbons are going to be cut by over 80%. So these are really big cuts, partly because it's a good rule, it's a very protective rule, but honestly, partly because cement kilns have never been required to cut their pollution much in the past.
Now, once mercury gets out into the air, does it become a hazard when it gets into the water system, which then gets into the food chain, and then we eat the methyl mercury in the form of fish?
Yes, that's the main exposure route for people. The mercury, of course, is an element, so it's not going to go away. Once it's in the air, it tends to fall back to Earth. A lot of it falls back locally, so that cement kilns are a regional, mercury polluter. And a lot of it also, cycles through the air and the rain and the water and keeps moving further north. So that's one reason that places like the Arctic have such bad mercury pollution. But in any event, people are exposed to it through eating fish primarily. From a people-centric point of view, that's the worst problem. But mercury pollution is also a problem for a lot of the species at the top of the food chain that eat fish. Things like killer whales, for example, polar bears, all these things that eat large fish or even eat mammals that eat fish also are suffering as a result of exposure to mercury.
Now, obviously, you got a lot of pushback, I'm sure, from the cement industry. As always, they say it's going to cost us a lot of money and cost jobs. What's the reality there, Jim?
Well, what's most interesting to me about the reaction from the cement industry is how sharply it changed from the time before the rule came out, when I believe they were attempting to change the rule and weaken it, to the day that the rule came out. Because before the rule came out, they were predicting the apocalypse. They were saying that as much as a third of the cement plants in the country were going to shut. It would be devastating to the industry. And they maintained this line for years without any real basis, without providing any substantiation for their claims. The day the rule came out, the organization that represents all these cement kilns said that maybe 10 kilns would be affected by the rule. Not shut, merely affected. And that was exactly what EPA had been saying all along, that there might be 10 of the 100 kilns that might be affected by the rule. And in fact, what EPA had also pointed out is that those 10 kilns, 9 were very old, very obsolete plants.
And should be closed.
Well, EPA didn't make a value judgment. They were just pointing out that they weren't really efficient anyway and were likely not, because they were running this old obsolete system that involved cooking wet cement, which takes a lot more energy, they weren't really competitive economically.
Now, you say this methylmercury, once it gets into the environment, doesn't go away. So a lot of what's already out there is going to be a problem for, years to come, if not decades, correct? And
that's
once
right.
It gets into the food chain.
It certainly helps to stop putting more in. And there have been studies that show that when a really big local source of mercury is controlled or stops emitting mercury, that the levels in the fish tissue in the water body surrounding that source go down pretty quickly. Now, the mercury, because it's an element, it does remain in the environment forever, but you can make really good improvements in the quality of the water bodies and the quality of the fish in those water bodies pretty quickly by getting the mercury out of the air.
Okay, so what happens next now that this has been agreed to?
Well, I'm not sure it's been agreed to all around. I suspect that industry is probably still going to try to stop it. They may try to stop it in court. I don't think that they have any valid arguments for doing that, but I just think that that's part of the process is that they have a system where they can fight it at every possible level. But what I expect will happen is that in the next few years the industry will be putting controls on their plants. The controls like better bag houses to capture their particulate matter, scrubbers to capture the acid gases and special controls to capture the mercury. And the within 3 years, which is the compliance date for this rule, the toxic emissions are going to go way down.
So we're all familiar with sort of the traditional, I guess it's called Portland cement. Is there a greener version of cement available today, Jim?
Well, I don't think it's available today. Portland cement is just talking about a way of making cement that was invented in Portland, England in the 19th century, and it's what we use. It's still, unfortunately, what we use today, which involves cooking rock, cooking crushed rocks in such a way that it turns into cement. There are some interesting technologies that don't involve cooking. But as far as I know, they aren't actually producing cement yet.
In the works. Okay. Because there's so many other green alternatives for different products that I thought perhaps the cement industry had caught up. Isn't there something about coal ash? I thought there was. Is coal ash a replacement product, or is that the bad component in cement?
Well, coal ash can be used in both in cement to substitute for some of the other mineral ingredients that would go into the kiln otherwise. And it can also be used to add to cement to make concrete, which is often the sort of the end product for cement anyway. And that's a mixed bag. Finding something to do with the coal ash can be a good thing. On the other hand, some of the coal ash itself can be very toxic. To give you one example that has been plaguing a community in Michigan, there's a cement kiln in Alpena, Michigan, that imports a bunch of coal ash from a power plant in Canada. Now, the power plant in Canada is actually controlling its mercury emissions to the air with scrubbers. And as a result of that, the coal ash from that plant is very highly laced with mercury. And what's so frustrating about this whole arrangement is that the mercury-laden coal ash, the mercury that the Canadians very carefully took out of their air at the power plant, is then shipped over to the cement plant in Michigan across the Great Lakes, put into the kiln, where it is then cooked out and sent out of the cement kiln stacks back toward the very same lake that it was, prevented from going into by the Canadians.
And I'm laughing, but it's
ridiculous, but it's also pretty tragic. It actually doubles the cement emissions from that plant and it goes from about 250 to about 500 pounds per year. Those aren't exact numbers, but it has a very big effect on the plant's mercury emissions. And so I think that the use of coal ash might be, sensible in some circumstances, but it has to be treated very carefully.
And just in terms of maybe there's no greener cement per se, but are there building materials that are being used to replace cement that you're aware of so that we're going to reduce our need to have so much and produce so much in the near future?
I'm not aware of those. I think that there are ways to make concrete with varying amounts of cement. So there may be ways to reduce our reliance on it to some extent, but I'm not sure that we have thought of any good ways to replace it. And I guess generally my thought is that if we make cement the way that this rule will require, it won't be the horrendous polluter that it's been in the past. It will be a much friendlier product. I think we can feel more comfortable about having cement if we know that it doesn't involve such amazingly high emissions of mercury and other toxic pollution.
But no concrete alternative, so to speak, at the moment that
right,
you're
no
aware
concrete
of.
Concrete alternative, right.
Okay, so we have about 10 minutes left, Jim. Tell us what else Earth Justice is up to. You guys are always doing good things on behalf of our planet, our home. What else is hot, so to speak?
Well, I'm glad you said hot, because that leads me to talk about waste burning, which is a very hot topic right now, because although most people don't know it, lots of industries across the country, you can think of refineries or paper mills or chemical plants, just about any big smokestack industry you can think of, has over the last couple of decades increasingly burned industrial wastes on site. And this is a very dangerous practice. There are all sorts of things that can conceivably be burned, things like used chemicals or scrap plastics or demolition waste, that has some wood in it, but also probably has metals and various other things. and burning these things in industrial boilers and process heaters, which is what's going on, can result in very dangerous emissions. And right now, those process heaters and boilers at big industries are still completely unregulated. Congress required EPA to put standards in place in 1994, so we're now 16 years late.
Let's see, who was in power in 1994?
That was Bill Clinton.
Okay, so he didn't do the job, and then we know Bush didn't. So there's no regulations on incineration?
There are no regulations on these incinerators, even though Congress identified these industrial incinerators as, you know, bad enough and scary enough that they should have been prioritized for some of the first regulations when the Clean Air Act, right after the Clean Air Act was enacted in 1990. So Congress said, get this job done really quickly, get it done by 1994. And EPA still hasn't done it. And right now we are, the agency under the Obama administration has finally proposed some rules. But regrettably, this is not a case where the agency has gotten things right. It has come out with a set of rules that will leave the vast majority of these incinerators untouched. And we're deeply concerned about this.
Why is that, Jim?
Why are we concerned, or why are they doing it?
No, why is the EPA, which otherwise seems to be a pretty good leadership gathering group there, they get it. Why are they missing the ball on this one, missing the point, sorry?
No, I mean, I think that's a tough question to answer. There are a few possible answers, but I don't have knowledge of what goes on inside the agency, I don't know exactly what their thinking is. But I think there are a few things that are going on. One is that unfortunately the group that handles solid waste, for some reason, seems more ideologically aligned with the Bush administration than the rest of the agency, and the political goodness of the Obama administration just hasn't seemed to have reached that particular group of people.
Hasn't trickled down to the solids yet.
Another is that it just hasn't had the kind of outside pressure and attention that some of the other issues have got. So even though the Obama administration is good, it still lives in a political world. And without the kind of pressure from community groups and public health groups and environmental groups, it's harder for the agency, even this agency, to do the right thing.
Well, what about neighborhoods and communities that live near incinerators? Aren't they putting pressure on? Because they certainly are most affected.
That's what I think is, in some ways, is so upsetting and potentially tragic about this. Most communities don't even know that they're living next to an incinerator. What they know is that they're living next to a chemical plant. And they may not be happy about that, but there is no way they would know that chemical plant is also burning its spent chemicals in a boiler or a process heater. And because it doesn't have to have a permit, or doesn't necessarily have to have a permit, there's no reporting, there's no monitoring, and of course there are no standards. So it wouldn't matter if it was being monitored anyway, because they can emit as much pollution as they like.
So do you have a campaign underway at Earth Justice to try to get people to become more aware and demand action?
We do, and we think we're starting to developed some momentum. More than 100 groups wrote into EPA and said, this is not right. Lisa Jackson, our administrator, has said that she's in favor of protecting communities and allowing plants to burn their waste on site without controls and without monitoring, without telling the neighbors, is the antithesis of protecting communities. And so there's a growing awareness of this issue, but I think that it's going to take a lot to overcome the industry pressure on the other side, because you have to imagine that this is something that every major industry in the country has a big economic incentive to do. They want to be able to burn their waste without having to control the pollution. They don't want to have to pay for controls. They don't want to have to report what they're emitting and take the public pressure that will result. So it's interesting, when you look at the record for this rulemaking, you will see just about every major industry group you can conceive writing in and saying, we like this. we don't want to have
to. We love this. Oh, yeah. No problem.
Right.
Unbelievable. You wonder what they're breathing and what they think their kids and grandkids are going to be breathing.
Well, I don't know, but I suspect they're probably not living in the most impacted communities.
Well, that's getting into the whole environmental justice question, isn't it?
It sure is, and there's no way to avoid that. This is an environmental justice question.
Well, that's one you guys are great about fighting and raising awareness on, and that's what the Green Front does, is put a microphone in front of all the good works that Earth Justice and lawyers like yourself are doing. So in our remaining few minutes, anything else you want to talk about? If not, I have my thoughts about what's going on around the planet in terms of climate change, if you want to weigh in on that. Talk about, it's just going to take a lot more, evidence to convince the doubters, the deniers, that there's something going on here that's not very good. It's not nice to fuel Mother Nature. We've seen so much evidence of that. But if there's something else you'd like to bring up instead of that,
I can't think of anything else I can cover briefly, and I would hesitate to offer my views on climate change because I simply don't have the expertise on that subject. But I'd be happy to listen.
As a citizen of the planet, you probably have noticed we've had some even weirder weather than usual this summer in terms of heat records being melted. I mean, first ever, with storms being more intense and in places they're not supposed to be. I was up at Lake Tahoe last week, which is right on the border between California and Nevada for our international audience, and we were sitting down for an outdoor concert on the mountain when it started raining, and within 5 minutes it was hailing, and it was hailing even more intensely, and that was a storm that lasted for about an hour and a half. We had Michael McDonald cancel the concert. Now that may not be unusual on the East Coast, but it's pretty unusual for California, and we've had some strange weather even for California, which is pretty mild. So I guess I just am putting out there to our listeners and to you to let's all start connecting the dots and pay attention to what, our weather is trying to tell us, Mother Nature is trying to tell us, and hopefully it will reach all the way, maybe a big enough piece of hail will hit somebody on the head in the Senate in Washington to say, oh, whoops, maybe we should do something now before it's too late.
We've been having strange enough weather that's not out of the realm of likelihood. I certainly hope it happens.
Or maybe all the heat can melt the resistance of those who would otherwise deprive us of serious, strong legislation to address climate change. It's mind-boggling, isn't it, Jim? Sometimes
it certainly is mind-boggling that there are politicians who have the cynicism to deny that it exists. I can see that reasonable people could debate what they want to do about it, but to pretend that it doesn't exist is just so irresponsible and so disappointing.
If flat earthers just keeps coming to mind when we talk about the deniers, what's it going to take? And somehow, instead of them looking like the idiots, it seems like sometimes they're, making headway and making the scientists look like they're missing a screw. And that's what we've got to turn around. I mean, scientists. Versus the Sean Hannitys of the world. But don't get me started on what's wrong with this media landscape here. Thank you so much for joining us, Jim.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your input, and congratulations on the good fight and finally a victory. And let's hope it goes into effect without too much opposition and in the near, not too distant future. You're listening to The Green Front. My next guest is a friend, Diane McEachern. She is the author of a book called The Big Green Purse. She is a woman who has been on the Green Front lines longer than I have. And we are friends, we are colleagues, and we are going to be talking to her in just a few minutes. Stay with us. Right after these messages, we'll talk about how you, as a consumer, can get involved in your community and get your local store to carry more green products. Diane will tell you how they're doing that as we speak.